Hi, Jacob.
Before I first came to Alatine, I would anger easily. Little things would tick me off, and they'd last for a long time. I wouldn't say I'm sorry, even if I started it. I would instead take it out on other people or on my dog, even if they weren't involved. Because I was mad, people didn't want to be around me. I was also unsure of myself. I would always look at my bad characteristics and wouldn't change the ones I could. I had to put people down in order to feel bigger, which made them not like me. I felt inferior because I wasn't looking at my good side, and I felt bad. I tried to change other people rather than myself, when actually I can only change myself. It was a never-ending battle to change someone else because they have to change themselves. I felt sorry for myself. Feeling sorry for myself didn't change anything. It just made me feel bad. When I was just starting Alatine, I started to see the good side of me as well as my bad. It helps me to make a personal inventory of myself and focus on changing the bad rather than looking at it and letting it sit unchanged. I started to want to change myself. I also learned what to do or say so as not to trigger off a fight, like when somebody comes up to me looking for a fight, not to get defensive. After I was going to Alatine for a while, I felt better about myself, and so I looked and acted normally, so I was better liked. I started to take pride in myself. I was friendlier, so people liked being around me. One of the most important things to me that I learned was how to react. Proper reactions can stop an argument or prevent one from happening. It can also relieve tensions. I also practiced the serenity prayer. Although it was hard for me, I am trying. Alatine has helped me help myself to get rid of my bad characteristics and to try to live with things I can't change, taking problems one day at a time and solving them. To stop going to Alatine is to give up a good thing. When I didn't go for 1 or 2 weeks, I suddenly think it's easier not to go. Things get in the way and weeks become months, months become seasons, and before long I start slipping into my old bad habits again. And when I finally come back, it's like coming home again.
Thank you, Jacob. That was very nice. My son actually plays Little League Baseball with that man. Between speakers, I'd like to make one announcement. Tomorrow's breakfast, okay, will be upstairs in the Lewis and Clark Room buffet style, starting at 7:30 to 9:30. Your program says it'll be down here also, but we're not going to have it down here. We're going to have it upstairs, buffet style in the upper area. Our next speaker is from California. I got sober in Hawaii, and all our speakers came from California. I moved to Montana, and some of our speakers are from California. She's an incredible lady who has an incredible story. Winnie E. from California.
Hi, everybody. My name is Winnie Eddy. I'm the wife of an alcoholic, a member of Al-Anon, and I'm not always happy with either one.
Hi, Winnie.
I will confess that Al-Anon seems to be a little more reliable than himself, but he assures me that is a matter of opinion. I would like to thank the committee for inviting me to come to Montana. This is my first trip to the Big Sky Country. And my only excuse is that you weren't on Route 66, because that was my path. I don't know, always felt like I discovered most of the places, even if they were bars. I didn't know for a long time that there was towns between California and Missouri until I sobered up and found out that I had traveled through places that I couldn't even remember. Now, I'd like to tell you right off the top that I am not an authority on Al-Anon. I haven't got the slightest idea how it works, and I'm glad. Because if I knew how it worked, I'd change it. That's my pattern, figure it out and improve on it. I didn't come to Al-Anon for any of the good reasons. I didn't come because I wanted it or needed it or even thought they could help me. I didn't know there was anything wrong with me. I came because I'm married to a nut. And he decided to go into the hospital and do something about his drinking, despite the help I had been giving him. And one of the conditions was that he attend AA meetings. Now, would you believe he took the time to sit down, write a letter to the Al-Anon Central office, and tell those complete strangers there was something wrong with me. And when I got to Al-Anon, I didn't stay for any of the good reasons, because I didn't like it. I didn't like it to the point that I tried to join Alcoholics Anonymous. I took their 20 questions test, and I flunked it. And so I went to the man that I thought was the high mucky muck in our area, because he seemed to be the fellow that always got the chair with the seat in it. For the benefit of those who have come into the fellowship recently, the Alano clubs today are beautifully furnished. When I came in, they used to furnish them with rejects from the Goodwill. And if you didn't hit your bottom before you got there, you did very shortly afterwards. But this guy always seemed to get the chair that had the seat in it. And so I figured, well, he must be the big guy. And so I went to him one day and I confessed. I said, I think I'm an alcoholic. And he said, well, what makes you think so? I said, well, I flunked your test. Well, he said, if you flunked the test, chances are you're an alcoholic. When did you have your last drink? Well, I said, I think about 3 years ago. And he said, lady, if it's been 3 years and you got to think about it, go back over with them women and let them help you. And I don't know about anybody else, but in my weakened condition, being rejected by Alcoholics Anonymous had a disastrous effect. But I went back over to those women, and I didn't stay for any of the good reasons. I actually stayed because there was one female in that group that was the nastiest woman I had ever come in contact with. And I decided to out-sit her. Now, it wasn't so much what she said to me, because she never really said anything. But she'd look at me and she'd go... And I wasn't accustomed to being treated like that. And she knitted. That almost drove me up a wall. Because I don't knit. I did it one time, but... Well, it was really the Red Cross that changed my path. I used to knit, you know, during World War II. And for some reason or other, I had trouble with the sleeves. You know, they'd always hang down around their ankles, and it was a waste of goodwill, so they put me to wrapping bandages. And even today, you know, when Eddie can't get a rise out of me any other way, he'll say, when are you going to finish that sweater you started for me in 1942? And in true Al-Anon tradition, I have saved it. And someday I'm going to finish it so we can see the changes there's been in his life since 1942. But anyhow, if you have a mental picture of that female with her tongue going while her knitting needles went click, 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 then you know why I'm here. And I didn't even begin to believe I was sick, which is one of the first things they told me, until I started to like her. And then I went to my sponsor and I confessed. I said, I think I'm beginning to like her. And my sponsor had one answer for every situation. It's all right. I could have told her I murdered my husband and she'd say, it's all right, you know. And I said, no, it's not all right. And she said, well, why isn't it? And I said, because I have never changed my mind about anyone. And that was the truth. You see, I put people in categories, those that you encouraged, those that you tolerated, and those that you ignored. And once I had you placed, you had to stay there. See, because I didn't know how to move you around. And I realized today that I probably deprived a great many people deprived myself of a great many meaningful relationships because of my inability to allow people to be whatever they wanted to be. Now, I know there are some alcoholics in the group tonight, and if you don't mind, I'd like to give them their message first. Well, you know how they are. The truth of the matter is that I'm not even sure I got a message for him, but I was talking in Fontana, which is a small town just east of where I live, one night, and after the meeting, a girl came up to me and she said, "Oh, where are you going to be the next time?" And I said, "Well, I'm not sure. Why?" Well, she said, "I'd just love to have my husband hear you." So I figured I must have said something profound and I couldn't remember what it was, so I asked her, "Do you think I could help your husband?" "Well," she said, "not really, but after he hears you, he's going to be glad he got me." So that may be the only message you get. But if you have as difficult a time with gratitude as I did, maybe it ain't all that bad. I only have one story, and I try to follow the prescription of telling a little bit about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today, although in Southern California there are some people that still are making book that I'm not going to make it. And so in my particular case, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I used to be like, what happened, and let you guess. That way everybody gets into the act. I grew up in a family where there was a drinking problem, and I used to say that my father was an alcoholic. But I don't know really whether he was or not. He didn't think he was. He thought he was a social drinker. He lived a social drinker, and he died a social drinker. But he liked it. And when I wasn't helping him, he liked me too. But in growing up, it wasn't so much what my father did that bothered me. It was what my father wouldn't do that bothered me. You see, I'm a born researcher. And at a very early age, I began to research fathers. Now, this does entail a little footwork. You have to go up and down the block, and you look at this father and the way he treats his child and this, you know, cover the whole bunch, and then come home and look at mine. He never did any of the things that I thought he ought to do, and I did make a few suggestions. But I was raised in a hard-headed Irish family, and for some reason or other, my father refused to take direction from a 4, 5, or 6-year-old, whatever I happened to be. And so right then, I began to get even with him. I ignored him. And ignoring him is what made my life most miserable. Because when I was away at school, I could be honest about my mother, my brothers, and my sister, but never my father. Always described him the way I wished he was. Sort of a composite picture of all the good things I thought a father ought to be. And this made things difficult because it meant nobody could go home with me. You see, if they did, they were going to find out one of two things right now. The man that was living with my mother was not my father. Or that I was the biggest liar that ever came down the pike. Now, I never considered myself a liar. I looked upon myself as a diplomat. Because I didn't lie, I just didn't tell the truth. And I thought there was a difference. You see, I learned at a very early age that people anticipate what you're going to say. So if you lead them up to a certain point and stop, they guess what you would have said if you'd have gone on. But they're very poor guessers. However, I never felt I should be held responsible for their inadequacies. And I have trouble with that even sometimes today, because since my husband's been sober and taken an interest in my welfare, which is just a nice way of saying he don't tell me to drop dead as often as he used to. But if I'm going someplace that's quite a ways away, he usually volunteers to go with me. Now this, at least for me, is a test of serenity. Because I'm married to the original, don't know where he's going when he leaves, he don't know where he is when he gets there, and he usually don't know where he's been when he gets back. But if he goes with me, he directs me every step of the way, you know? And we're at opposite ends of the pole when it comes to being anything alike, because I'm married to a thinker. Sometimes he thinks 2-3 weeks before he answers you, you know? Which is really all right. It's a marvelous memory course, because you have to keep in mind everything you've been talking about. Because when he comes up with the answer, he never connects it to anything, see? He just says, yes, and you... Well, I'll give you a better example. Since he's given up drinking, he's taken up dusting. And that's almost as bad as drinking. But we were playing golf one day, and I happened to look over, and he was dusting the golf cart. And I thought, this is ridiculous, you know? So when I got back in the cart, I merely said to him, when you die, I'm going to bury you in a plastic bag. And he didn't say anything, so I didn't say anything. But about 2 weeks later, we were having a nice, quiet, friendly cup of coffee, and out of a clear blue sky, he said, I don't think that was very nice. He thought it over, and he didn't like the bag idea. But on the other hand, I'm one of those people that reacts immediately. See, I try to get it done for you. Tell me what you want me to do. In fact, if I walked in here, and you were all down on your hands and knees looking for something, I'd get right down and help you. I don't even know what you're looking for, see? But God forbid anybody should come through that door and find me up and you down, you know? That's So when you put two people like that in one automobile, you got a problem. Because when we're driving down the freeway, if he says turn right, I turn right now. And he usually says, not here. So, on this particular night, I had been asked to come down to Chula Vista, and that's another one of them Spanish names. And I was having a moment of growth, or whatever you want to call it. I just wasn't well enough to go that far with him. And I didn't want to tell him I didn't want him to go, because, well, he gets such a hurt look, you know. And then I have to make all them amends and so forth. So I just said to him, I'm going to a meeting, and he said, okay, and I left. Only that night I didn't get home at 10:30 or a quarter of 11. It was more like a quarter of 1. And when I walked through the door, there he stood in my spot with that age-old question, where the hell have you been? And without even thinking, I said, well, how far do you think it is to Chula Vista? Now, he accused me of lying to him, but I didn't lie to him. I didn't tell him I wasn't going to Chula Vista. And if he had said, Winnie, are you going to Chula Vista? I was willing to say yes. See? Are you getting the picture? If you were bright enough to ask the right question, you got the whole story. And if you weren't, you got stuck with what you thought. And I might add that if you've never tried that, it's one way to get into lots of trouble on your own. But anyhow, my father did have one habit, kind of slopped over into later years, and that was sleeping on the living room floor. Now, it wasn't that he liked sleeping on the living room floor. That's the way it worked out. You know, he'd come home and he'd sit down, then he'd lean down, then he'd lay down. And my mother, being the type person she was, let me understand, that's his business. You tend to your business, we should have no problems. So I used to step over him and go about my business. But what I should have done was step on him. See, because he bothered me on that living room floor. And when I got one of my own that used to pick peculiar places to sleep, I didn't care if he was on the porch, the lawn. I would really have preferred something like the LA freeways. Because Eddie had a double indemnity clause in his insurance, and that was one of the first games we ever played. You know, I kept paying the premiums, and he took vitamins with his beer, but I couldn't stand him on the living room floor. And I can remember to this minute taking him by the heels and pulling him, you know, and his head bounced, but I loved it when his head bounced. There was something about that thud that made me feel good deep down inside, you know? Because I wanted to hurt him the way I thought he was trying to hurt me. And drunk as he was, you know, he'd say, you're not mad at me, you're mad at your father. And of course, I had one standard answer: compared to you, my father was a Boy Scout. Now, the tragedy of that is that that's what I tried to live with. You see, a long time ago, probably farther back than I'll ever admit to, I became disenchanted with reality. Reality was something that I could not do anything with, And I realize probably today the reason is because facing reality requires certain things. One of them being that you have to do something about the thing that is staring you right in the face. And because of my inability playing that little game of let's pretend. Now that's okay if you happen to be 2 or 3 years old, or maybe even up to 10. But if you carry it through your life as I did until I came into Al-Anon, then you're like me. You end up in a nightmare because you don't know what is real and what isn't real. Now, I don't know what happened to the man that I met, fell in love with, and permitted to marry me, but as soon as he was mine, I decided to help him. I wanted to help him become what I knew he wanted to be for my sake. And I'm not well enough yet to define that for you, but I'll tell you something that I didn't tell him. My help is deadly. I had friends that wouldn't tell me they were in trouble for fear I'd help them. But of course, when Eddie and I got married, we ceased to be friends. We became competitors. He spent his life trying to outwit me, and I spent my life trying to outwit him. And the upshot of the whole thing is we ended up a couple of halfwits. But he was in the Navy. He was a professional man. He was a full lieutenant. And I didn't go into this blindly. As I told you before, I'm a researcher, and I researched the Navy. And unfortunately for me and the Navy, I came across the table of operations, and I noticed that there was only a couple of lines between what he was and what I decided to help him become, which was admiral. Now, I knew they only had one admiral in the dental corps, but I only had one man in mind for the job. It didn't look as difficult as it turned out to be. But had I been even halfway bright, I would have joined the Navy myself, because I showed up every day. Nobody had to worry about me. He only showed up when the spirit moved him. And I would have made a marvelous shore patrolman, because I got a little bit of bird dog in me. And when I'd show up and find out he hadn't shown up, I'd just put my nose to the ground and away I'd go. And sooner or later I'd find him. But of course, by that time, he was usually in no shape for me to let anybody else find him. So that's when I used to hide him. We played hide and seek for years. He didn't even know there was a game going on, you know? But after he came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt I had to help him with the program. I just wasn't sure he was bright enough to get what they said they were willing to give him. And so I would go to every meeting, and I had a small notebook, and I would jot down a few of the pertinent things that applied to his peculiar case. And then I'd spoon feed it to him. Well, you know, I wanted him to, if they had an examination, at least be able to pass. And I want you to know that I heard two things at those meetings that are worse than drinking. Lots of things are worse than drinking. Sobriety, for instance. It's only an opinion, but I think it was a lot easier to watch him throw up than it was grow up. It was just seemed to come more natural. But anyhow, one of the things I heard was sleep teaching. I got myself a big AA book, and every night, just as Eddie would go to sleep, I would open it to chapter 5, and I would read to him. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. You should have heard that reading. It was the perfect, you know, the right emphasis, the right phraseology. I memorized the whole 5th chapter, and dummy slept through the whole thing. But I sometimes think when we go to an AA meeting outside our own area, you know, where people, when you walk in, don't really know which one is which. For some reason or other, it's always me they come up to. And they'll say, keep coming back, honey, because it works. I heard a fella up in Lancaster, sometime back now, but he said one of the things that made it difficult for him to come to Alcoholics Anonymous was the fact that none of them looked like alcoholics. And he figured in the 15 and a half years he'd been associated with the fellowship that he had run into approximately 250,000 alcoholics. And of those, only 10 really looked like alcoholics. But they turned out to be Al-Anons. So if there's anybody here wanting to know where the gate is, that's it, you know. Well, anyhow, the other thing I heard was, you can't get drunk if you're grateful. Now, right after I came to Al-Anon, they removed from my vocabulary some of my finer phrases, such as, you had better not be drunk tonight. If I smell liquor on your breath, your clothes will be on the porch. My neighbors thought I was some kind of a fresh air nut. I put them out every night, brought them in every morning, you know. But they wouldn't let me say that, and so I had to find some way to get the message across to him and still stay within the narrow confines of this organization. And so when I heard that bit about gratitude, I latched right onto it. And every morning when Eddie would leave for the office, I would say, remember, today, be grateful. And he'd say, for what? So I used to give him things to be grateful for. But I wasn't really all that grateful myself in those days. So one day I was sitting there trying to think of things to give him to be grateful for when I happened to remember this game of hide and seek. And so I explained to him, because I'm a great explainer. I don't know about anybody else, but I was never able to say yes or no without a detailed explanation as to how I arrived at that particular conclusion, and I'm not much better than that today, you know, because, well, just here not too long ago, I always wanted a watch with a little teeny-weeny tiny face, you know, the kind that you would expect Loretta Young to swish into a room with. And as soon as my eyes got bad, Eddie got me one, and well, they have their own ways of getting even with you, don't think they don't. But anyhow, I complained about it so much that he finally got me a bigger one, and in my enthusiasm, I pulled a stem out of it. And I didn't want him to think I was abusing his gifts, so I fixed it myself, and it worked for quite a while. Of course, you had to keep it wound, because if you forgot, you were dead for 12 hours. You couldn't set the darn thing. But anyhow, I happened to be up in Kanab, Utah, and some poor soul, noticing that I had a watch, asked me what time it was. So naturally, I had to tell him about the watch with the little teeny-weeny face and then the bigger watch and pulling the stem out, the bad eyes, and having to keep it wound. There's an hour's difference between Kanab and California, and this gains 5 minutes every 24 hours, and I looked up and the man was gone. And I don't know what happened to him. You know, I guess he just didn't have time to wait to find out what time it was. But anyhow, that's the way I am. But of course, Eddie was a captive, so I had plenty of time to explain to him that when he used to drink excessively, it had been necessary for me on occasion to hide him. And I had put him in some rather out-of-the-way places, but I'd never lost him, so be grateful, you know. And I did put him in some strange places. The one I always tell about happened at the Long Beach Naval Station. And I tell it primarily because it points out so many things about me. They had a mock submarine just inside the sentry gate down there, and I came across Lloyd John in front of this mock submarine with his six-pack of beer at the exact moment that I spotted his commanding officer coming from the opposite direction. And I had just told this man one of my better stories, which meant I had to get rid of him. I mean, you can understand. He was living proof that I hadn't told him the whole story. But what you have to know is that Eddie had gotten conditioned to me. When I came to Al-Anon, I could throw a full six-pack of beer farther than he had strength enough to retrieve it. So if I was around and he had a six-pack of beer, he'd hold it like he was, you know, making some kind of an escape. Well, anyhow, when I spotted this commanding officer, the only place I had to put him was in that submarine. And it wasn't as hard as it sounds. I just helped him up and he fell down. But getting him out, that was a whole nother story, you see, because he didn't trust me. He wouldn't hand me the beer. And I have many times since wondered what that sentry must have thought of that female, half in, half out of the conning tower, that darn submarine, finally coming up with this lieutenant commander holding his beer in his hat. He didn't know whether he was going up or down, you see, because I used to go on that base like I owned it, in my house coat and my curlers. I don't really think the alcoholic appreciates what we give up in order to help them. In my particular case, it was dressing. I did have a choice. I could always go to bed in whatever I was going to wear the next day, but I don't know. You don't get that same comfortable feeling you have with one of them old house coats, you know? And mine was a chenille number. Whenever anybody would ask me something that upset me, I would pluck it, you know? I went through life plucking that damn house coat. Well, I guess you know how I felt when Eddie came home and announced he had resigned from the Navy. I was like somebody that had lost a business, really, because I was beginning to wonder about him, although I never blamed the drinking. I didn't want my husband to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and quit drinking. I wanted him to learn to mind. See? And that's one of the reasons that I had so much trouble with that first drink. I went around for a long time. When somebody would say, first drink, I would go into great detail. It is not the first drink. But I couldn't remember whether it was the second, the third, or the fourth. You know, I got so bad about that that my sponsor finally said to me, don't help him, Winnie. Let him suffer. And so I quit talking about it. And then one night I went to a meeting and this AA speaker talked almost exclusively on the first drink. And later on, of course, I ran into him in the coffee shop, and I spotted him, and I said to Eddie, I'm just going to run over there and tell that man how much I enjoyed his talk. However, I do think he should be a little more factual, because it really isn't the first drink. And let's give the devil his due. My husband never deprived me of making as big a jackass out of myself as I wanted to. And he sat right there while I traipsed across that coffee shop, sat down with this complete stranger, and picked his talk apart. And I explained to him that it wasn't the first drink, but I couldn't remember whether it was the second or the third or the fourth. And he sat there almost in a state of shock, you know. And when I got through, he just kind of stared at me for a minute. And he happened to be a railroad man from Texas. And when I got all through and he got over his shock, he looked at me and he says, well, honey, let me put it to you this way. When you get hit by a train, it ain't the caboose that kills you. And from that day to this, whenever anybody mentions a first drink, I see a train go right by me, you know. But in those days, you see, I didn't blame the drinking, and I think one of the reasons is because I used to like to go to the cocktail parties. I enjoyed that nice, easy social life in the service, and I didn't even mind making a darn fool out of myself once in a while. But he wanted to make a career out of it, you see? And I could never get across to him that if you are invited to a cocktail party on Friday, you can come home on Friday. You don't have to stay till Monday, you know? But the strange part of it is, and here again, it's only my opinion, but I think in the beginning, my husband and I had exactly the same problem, the problem of living. Because as his drinking increased, which is where he found his answer, mine decreased. I substituted drinking with his life. I crawled into his life, and all of a sudden it became more important for me to know where he was, who he was with, who he was talking to, what he was talking about, where he was going, how he was going to get there, than it was for me to settle down and enjoy myself. And I don't know about anybody else, but I know for a fact that in my life, that was one of the hardest habits that I had to break. The habit of trying to make somebody else's life make me happy. But I felt obligated to do something for him because everybody knows a good wife helps a good husband. Of course, he wouldn't be good, but I had to play his part too. And so while I was trying to decide what to do with him, I happened to remember his mother. And I didn't really like his mother, but, she, you know, always showed up at the wrong time, and I didn't have any other reason. But she was a person that didn't believe in drinking anything but water. So it dawned on me, that's his problem. You see, he wasn't raised in a social drinking family such as mine. So the poor thing just didn't know how to drink. And I decided to teach him. Have you ever tried to teach a drunk how to drink? You got one big problem. You got to get him sober enough to find out if he's learning anything that you're teaching him. So in order to do that, I decided to get him out of California because I hated California, and I was going to take him back to the Middle West where people are really people. Well, that's where I'm from. And that decision lasted, I'd say, oh, well, maybe 800, well, till we got to Gallup, New Mexico. And I spent three of the most miserable days of my life in that godforsaken place because Eddie got into a bar that I was afraid to follow him into. You see, from where I was sitting, he and a tribe of Indians went in. And I know what Indians and Firewater do when they get mixed up together. And they weren't going to get me in that godforsaken place, so I sat outside and waited. Never dawned on me there was a back door. He went in the front door, out the back door, wherever he wanted to go, in the back door, out the front door, and there was Old Faithful spouting right where he'd left her, you see. And I always like to mention the little Indian squaw that was standing in front of that place because I think she was my first contact with that certain something that I found in Al-Anon. In AA, they call it the unspoken language, but in Al-Anon, at least for me, I think it's the language of the heart. This is the only place in my life that I have ever been where I can feel what somebody else is saying, where I can watch somebody walk through the door for the first time. And I don't have to ask them who they are, where they came from, what their husband does. I don't have to know anything about them. I just look in their eyes. And when I see in their eyes that same, there ain't nobody home here look that I've seen in my eyes, I know where they've been. A girl from Montreal, I think, probably said it better than I could when she was visiting in California and she was describing how they handle their meetings up there. And she said, you know, we have greeters. And she said, when I went to my first meeting, and the girl put her hand out and said, my name is Ruby, I was so upset I couldn't tell her who I was. All I could say to her was, I've been to hell and back. And she said, you know, she never even hesitated. She just smiled sweetly and said, well, isn't it strange then that we've never met before? And that's the way it is. You see, whether I like to admit it or not, I paved that road to hell with my insecurity and my fear. And I didn't know who the Master Mason was until I got to Al-Anon. But I was a long way from Al-Anon in Gallup, New Mexico. I looked over at that little Indian squaw and I was absolutely embarrassed for her that she would allow herself to be degraded by standing in front of that place. I'm across the street making peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for five children, but she did look strange to me. Second day, she looked pretty good, and the third day, I kind of hid her, you know, because she had her side of the street, and I had mine, and if you've ever been to Gallup, that's all there is. But while I was there, I had to make one of my many decisions, and that's what my life has been, one decision after another. I decided I would never again stop where the human race could contaminate my husband. Now, if you're driving across country in an automobile and you don't intend to stop, you have to make adjustments. And some darn fool had told me that Texas had dry counties. So that's the adjustment I made. I mapped out a course so that we never stopped unless we were in a dry county. Now, it didn't do any good. He got just as drunk in a dry one as he would have in a wet one. But when you're going crazy on a slow, easy plan, this can help, you see? Because you can spend hours wondering, where did he get it? I don't know where they get it, but I know today that if I had locked him in a closet, he'd have come out drunk. And I don't know where they get it, you know? But my kids think Texas is the biggest place on earth because it took us almost 2 weeks to get through it. See, what this dummy forgot to tell me was that Texas puts one dry one between two wet ones. And we just kept going back and forth across Texas. And, of course, it was an unwritten law as far as the kids were concerned. If she stops and you got anything to do, get out, get it done, and get back. Because she'll never miss you. And that's about the way it was. You see, I concentrated on that seat. If it was full, we went. And if it was empty, we waited. See how simple it is? Of course, God alone knows how much travel time we lost when he got in the back by mistake. I never looked back then. Because that's not where he's supposed to be. And I could depend on those kids. They wouldn't have said anything because one of their favorite sayings, don't upset her. It used to upset me. And yet today, and it's only my opinion, but I don't think my kids reacted to the alcoholic. My kids reacted to my reaction to the alcoholic. Because sure, Eddie came home drunk lots of times, and he did very strange things. But they knew he was drunk, and they knew he was strange. How do you explain me? I'm leading the pack, and I don't know where I am half the time. You know? I had one son. I could not keep that kid in school. Take him to school, he beat me home. And after he got to go into Alateen, and I got to go into Al-Anon, and we could talk as people instead of God and the little child, which is the way it had been. And I asked him one day, I said, Billy, why wouldn't you go to school? Didn't you like school? He says, Mom, I really did, but I was afraid you'd move while I was gone. And you know, that can be a real fear as far as a kid is concerned. But anyhow, I finally got to Harrisburg, Illinois, chose it very carefully. It was my mother-in-law's hometown. I didn't like her, but I didn't mind using her. And she'd gotten herself elected secretary of the WCTU, and I figured, what's a better place to teach a drunk how to drink than underneath the nose of the Women's Christian Temperance Union? But they aren't as good at researching as I was, because we were there a very short time until I had found a War Dad's Club. And for $2, you could become a war dad, and once you became a war dad, you could drink all the beer you wanted. Well, I knew I couldn't stay there. For heaven's sakes, that was like dropping him off at the Schlitz Brewery and saying, I'll see you in 6 months, honey, you know? So while I was packing, I happened to remember that Kansas is a dry state. But don't you believe it? Everything they drink in Missouri, they must haul over from Kansas, because we were there less time than we were in Illinois until he found a bar within walking distance, because naturally I took the car away from him, just like you would any other 10-year-old child that you're taking care of. And so every morning he would walk down to this place, and it kind of tickled me. After he got sober, he told me that he had to pass a Catholic church on this little jaunt. Now, I'm Catholic, but he's not. In fact, for years I thought I was doing penance for marrying that Methodist, but anyhow, he took the time one day to go into that church, light a candle, and say a prayer for me. And then he noticed a sign that said the candle cost a quarter, and he didn't want to spend a quarter, so he blew it out. And I've never had nerve enough to ask him, was he praying for me or against me? You know, because that's about the time the fun started. Now, in my opinion, and here again, that's all I'm offering, but in my opinion, the non-alcoholic is by far sicker than the alcoholic. Because you take a drunk to a meeting and you get him sober, and right now, you're going to see a difference. But you take someone like me, perfect. Never did anything that I couldn't explain, if I had enough time. Devoted my life to my family, to my community, to the Red Cross, to the DAR, to the Navy Relief, to anything to get my hands on, really. And tell me I'm sick. How can you be sick and do what I did? Or that I have to change? How would you improve on perfect? And that's what I was. Miserable? Yes. Perfectly miserable. Nothing upset me like a good day. You ever had one of those? Where everybody is enjoying themselves and you're sitting there waiting and watching. Go to bed at night exhausted. Nothing happened. Yeah. Telephone used to be a great source of worry to me too. Oh, I never answered it, but I used to like to watch it. And it would ring, and it would ring, and it would ring, and when it stopped, my next thought, I wonder who it was. But it never occurred to me to answer it. The other reason I think the non-alcoholic is sicker is because occasionally, maybe Eddie wasn't sober, but he was dry. I was crazy all the time. Because if he quit drinking, I'd try to figure out, what did I do to stop him? And while I'm trying to figure out what did I do to stop him, he starts again. Now I gotta find out what starts him. So if I ever stop him, I'll never start him again, see? Over and over again. Well, I got on the watch, you know, with the no face, but I'm gonna do my best. Anyhow, he quit drinking all of a sudden, and I had decided to help him become a millionaire, but I didn't tell him what I had in mind. That's the worst thing you can do, you know, is to let them know that you're doing something, because they'll louse it up. They won't cooperate. And so I didn't tell Eddie what I had in mind. I just picked out a small, unsuspecting town in the state of Missouri that needed a dentist, went down to see a friend of my father. Look, you know, and I dare him not to do something, and he is not the world's bravest man. He usually would do it, and he did. We walked into the office, and this jerk says, "Listen, Doc, I'm allergic to Novocaine, but I got my own anesthesia." So he took a bottle out of his pocket. He had a drink. The dentist had a drink. They pulled the tooth, and they both went back to Blondie's. And that's when I made up my mind that that town could suffer. I wasn't going to help them. And yet tonight, as I have been many other nights, I am grateful that drunk as he was, sick as he was more emotionally stable than I was cold sober. Because you see, if he had worked on those people in the condition he was in, he could have made so many mistakes that I never would have lived long enough to make the amends that would have been necessary. And they would have been my amends. Because you see, that office represented to me success. And that's what I had searched for all my life. I was raised to believe that you had to be successful, but I didn't know what success was. I didn't really know until I got to Al-Anon. And my number one son was drafted, and I didn't really want to join the Army, but it looked like I was going to have to. Because he's very much like his father. And I thought, well, maybe there's another solution. So when I'd go to the meeting, you know, I'd kind of hint. Never came right out and told him what I had on my mind. And my girlfriend, the one with the in the knitting needles, you know, she was always kind of keyed into me. And one night she said, "Why don't you get off that kid's back and allow him the dignity of failure?" I'd never heard those two words used in the same sentence before. But she went on to say, if he never fails, he can't possibly succeed. Because if he's never experienced one thing, he'll never recognize the other. And do you know that since that night, I have never been to an Al-Anon meeting, to an AA meeting, or even to an Al-Ateen meeting. And I'll bet you haven't either. That you haven't watched absolute failure walk through that door, stick around, and become a success. Now, I don't mean from a monetary standpoint, because success to me today is not something that you invite people over to or drive them around the block in or wear to a party. Success to me today is the ability to get up in the morning, walk in, look in the mirror, and know who I am. To be able to stand right here, right this minute, and say, my name is Winnie Eddy, and know who I'm talking about. Because you see, all my life, I had a name, but I had no identity. I asked my sponsor that question one day. I said, how do you find out who you are? And of course, I had a sick sponsor, and she never answered my question. She'd always come back with something, and she did. She said, when you have cake for dessert, Winnie, how do you serve it? Well, God, there was no connection, but I figured I'll answer her question, and then she can get to mine. So I told her, I said, well, I take a pretty good sized piece and I give it to Eddie. And then I'm very even with the children. And sometimes there's a piece left over for me and sometimes there isn't. She said, that's the way you live your life, too. I said, what? She said, you take a great big chunk of your life and you give it to him. And then you're very even with the children. And sometimes there's a little piece left over for you and sometimes there isn't. And I said, well, my God, what do you do in a case like that? Well, she said, it's very simple. You just take the first piece of cake. And that's what I try to do one day at a time, to the best of my ability. I try to be good to me because I know that unless I am, if I try to do for you rather than me, eventually I will resent you because I will have marked up one more fall guy that I can blame for my own misery. Now, when I left California, I had, God, I wish I could read this. I had five children. I have eight altogether, and you got to count them as they creep in just like I did because I was always surprised, you know. Of course, Eddie was a little surprised when he sobered up, too, but that's... That's his story. I knew when I left California I was expecting a baby, but I was a person that always lived on a schedule. You know, make the beds at 7 o'clock, which isn't always easy if they don't get up till 8. And then I had all these other impossible things. And when you have five children, having a baby's no big deal, so I put that on the bottom. And I had been busy, but it was getting close to the time, so I went up to see this doctor. And whether you realize it or not, doctors are very happy people. Most of them are just glad you're sick, but they're happy. And this one was the joy boy of the whole bunch. You should have seen the treatment he gave me. You know, helped me in, sat me down, patted me on the head, and then he hit me with the bat. Mrs. Eddie, you're going to have twins. I almost died in his office. You know, because I got problems. I've got a dental office with no dentist, plus five, and that thing that I don't know what to do with. And besides, I knew what Eddie was going to say when I told him because he said it. There are no twins in my family. I got so involved defending my moral character that I forgot there were twins in my family. It wasn't until after they arrived and my mother said, isn't it nice we have another set of twins? I said, in whose family? She said, in ours. I said, well, why didn't you tell me? She said, you never ask me. See? But that's no big deal. I never ask anybody anything. Can you think of a better way for people to find out that you don't know something than to ask them? Why, even when I was lost, I'd drive into a filling station and I would say to the attendant, where are you located? Okay. Because I knew that if I found out where he was, I'd know where I was. And God forbid that this total stranger should ever find out that I was lost, you know. Well, can you imagine giving up all that traveling and all that excitement and everything else for things like this? That's what I had to do. I told you in the beginning that I'm grateful tonight, as I have been many other nights, that Eddie wrote that letter. I'm also grateful that God, as I understand him, sent me a sponsor who had the patience of Job, because I wasn't an easy nut to crack. First day she came out, she found the front door nailed shut. Well, I had to. I was in no shape to cover two doors. You know, I was pooped. And but she went around the back, and she found the car in the driveway and the coffee pot boiling on the stove, and she yoo-hooed me, but she couldn't find me. So she went next door, and she asked this little old lady whether or not Mrs. Eddie was at home, and Miss Martin said, well, even if she is... She thought I was crazy. And I resented that, really, because I never bothered that woman. Once we almost got trapped in the backyard together, and I hid in the bushes until she went in. And my children hadn't bothered her either. I didn't forbid them to go over there, because I have always believed that forbidding children to do things leaves scars on them. So I just used a little psychology, you know. Tell them the story of Hansel and Gretel and let them make up their own minds. You want to end up in an oven? But she scared Wilma, and when she came back that night, she had a friend with her. And I don't really know how she got in, but I will be eternally grateful that she did. She told me about Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon. I didn't even know they lived in our neighborhood. But she invited me to go to a meeting because she had friends that had been married to drunks, and she needed my help. I think that's the way she put it. But when she left that night, I gave her just time enough to get home, and then I called her and told her something very important had come up, and I would be unable to attend the meeting as scheduled. Now, I hadn't even done anything unimportant for a long time, but I couldn't let her find that out. And that should have been the first chink in the armor. That should have been the first time I began to realize I never hid from you. I hid from me. Because, you see, I was afraid I wasn't going to measure up to what I thought you thought I ought to be. And so I built a wall that was supposed to keep you from finding out how inadequate I was. And the sad part about it is that I'm the one that got lost behind that wall. Because when I came to Al-Anon, I didn't laugh, I didn't cry, I didn't care. I was just waiting, hoping that the inevitable would come soon. I didn't have an easy time with this meeting because I fought it every step of the way. My sponsor made the mistake of telling me that we have the same steps in Al-Anon that they have in Alcoholics Anonymous, so that's the way I worked it. I wasn't powerless over alcohol, and if it hadn't been for him, I could have managed beautifully, so I figured that's his step, so I left it for him. Second one had an unfortunate word. It said, came to believe a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Well, now, if you analyze that, you will come to realize, as I did, that you got to be crazy before you can be restored. Well, I wasn't nuts, but he was, so I left that one for him, too. But I skipped the third one for both of us. It asked me to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. Well, I understood him. He just didn't understand me. And I didn't hate Eddie enough to turn him over. So I skipped that one for both of us. Because, you see, when I came to Al-Anon, I wasn't going to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, not on your life. I'd give it to anybody else who wanted it. You know, the analogy I usually use is the L.A. freeway. When I get on that freeway, go right over to the left-hand lane because that one goes straight ahead, and that's where I'm going. But there's always some stinker that'll get on the freeway, move over right in front of me, and slow down. Which means I got to get in front of him and slow down so he'll know how I feel. And so he gets in front of me, and I get in front of him, and he gets in front of me, and about 5 miles out, he goes off to the right, gets off the freeway. He's home. 5 miles past my turn. See? Because he has had control of my life. But no, I was not going to turn it over to God. But I did notice that when I would call my sponsor with little problems, and she would say, turn it over. But she never told me to whom. Which I could understand. I mean, it is an anonymous program. You just don't tell everybody who handles the problems. And so I didn't push her. But then the day came when I had what I thought was a particularly big situation, and I called her, and she said the same thing, you know, turn it over. I said, Wilma, for months you've been telling me to turn it over, but you never told me to whom. Oh, she said, I thought you knew. You turn it over to God. I said, not in your life. I'm not turning nothing over to God. I'm not even telling him I'm going to Al-Anon if you want the truth. And this made her unhappy. And I didn't want her to be unhappy. I mean, the woman wasn't really bright, but she was convenient. And so I began to wonder, what could I turn over that God couldn't louse up that would make her happy? And it took me about 3 days, and then I called her on the phone, and I said, Wilma, I'm turning something over to God. She said, good. What are you turning over? I said, my ironing. She said, you're ironing? I said, well, you said it didn't make any difference. Oh, no, no. She said, that's fine, that's fine. And I want you to know that God don't like to iron either. Because I used to keep my ironing in a nice cabinet all ready to, you know, in case I got the urge. I turned it over to God. It ended up in boxes. The boxes ended up in the... It was a mess. And every time she'd come to my house, I'd say, have you seen the ironing? And she'd give me the second routine, you know. It's all right. So I figured if it don't bother her and it don't bother him, I'm not going to let it bother me. And then one night I went to an AA meeting. And after the meeting, a man came up and he said, "Say, Winnie, you got a bunch of kids, don't you?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, I go to an orphanage down in Mexico. And those little kids could certainly use anything that possibly your kids have outgrown." So I promised him faithfully I would go right home, I'd get them all together, he could pick them up at his leisure. But I am a procrastinator by profession. He didn't follow me home by morning, I forgot he asked me. And sometime after that, and I'm not sure of the span of time, but I came home from an Al-Anon meeting one night, and Eddie said Bill was by, and he picked up the stuff for the orphanage. I said, "He did?" He says, "Yeah." I said, "Where did you get it?" He said, "The box is in the rumpus room." You're right, that was my irony. And I want you to know that from that day to this, I have no problems turning things over to God. Because my God, as I understand him, has some of the most unique answers. I never would have thought of sending them to Mexico. And besides that, he made me look good, you know? Now, I don't tell that story to be blasphemous, because without the spiritual part of this program today, I don't believe I could survive. But I don't think God wants to listen to me cry for the rest of my life. And I don't think one of the biggest questions he's going to ask me is, "How many cracks did you count in the sidewalk?" If you want to know my honest opinion, I think it gives God a charge to hear me laugh. To know that finally, thanks to you and this way of life, I'm really enjoying myself. And so I try to keep kind of a light touch. Now, I can't do it 100% of the time, but I'm grateful for that. God knows I was perfect when I got here, you know? And look at the shape I was in. So I don't mind making mistakes occasionally, but I do try to keep it as light as I can. 2 years ago, I went to Germany with my son Frank, who's very much like me, to visit my son Arthur, who's also very much like me. They're all like me. And we got off the plane in Frankfurt. We didn't know where we were. We didn't know where we were going. We couldn't speak the language. We couldn't understand it. We were in what you might call up a paddle without a, or up the creek without a paddle. And the first English words we heard, "Your luggage is lost." Well, my son Frank went right into orbit. He said, "My God, Mother, what are we going to do?" I said, "We're going to be the first people through customs." And we were. See? Because we were standing right in the middle of everything we had with us. And the next day we were in Berlin. The luggage was in Berlin. They even delivered it. So I concluded God just didn't want to stop in Frankfurt. That's all. But the point I'm trying to make is, no matter how many times or how many hours I worried about that luggage, I would not have gotten it back because I worried about it. I got it back because I was supposed to get it back. The first speaker I ever heard was a gal who always started to talk off by saying, "My name is Fran and I love an alcoholic." And I wanted to knock her down. I mean, getting stuck with one is one thing, but to get up there and brag about it, I thought was rather risque even for this organization. And so at the next meeting, they always encouraged the newcomer to speak their mind, and I told them how I felt. I just didn't think the sick one should be allowed up there. And as a result of that little honest statement, those females gave me an assignment. I was to go home, take Eddie's hand, and say, "Eddie, I love you. That's all." I said, "You're kidding." "No, that's what you have to do." And would you believe I was so sick I didn't know I didn't have to do it? And it took me almost 3 months to do it. And I didn't do it then because I wanted to. I did it because every time I went to that darn meeting, one of them females would say, "Have you done it yet?" And I didn't know how to sidestep a yes or no answer, you know? And I didn't want to lie to them because I didn't know what they did to you if they caught you lying. You know, I had seen people come in there that just disappeared. I didn't know what happened to them. So one night when the light was off, I reached over and I took Eddie's hand and I said, "Eddie, I love you." He sat right straight up in bed. He said, "What the hell's the matter with you now?" Which is not one of life's most romantic answers. But I found out something that I couldn't have found out any other way. You see, I found out that no matter how many times he tells me, no matter how many ways he tries to prove, nor to what extremes he goes to convince me of how he feels about me, if I'm not in the mood to accept it, he's wasting his time, see? Because I control that little button that says, yes, he's telling the truth, no, he isn't, well, I'm not sure, you see? I don't need him to make me miserable. I just have to have time to think. But at the same time, I found out something else. I found out how I truly feel about him. And that's why tonight, when I say, my name is Winnie Eddy and I love an alcoholic, that's reality. Now, I don't make excuses for him. I don't try to explain him because I don't understand him. I try one day at a time to allow him the dignity to live his life the way he wants to. And I hope and pray to God that if he should ever decide to take another drink, that I will be allowed to accept him as he is. Now, I keep coming to Al-Anon because I'm a person who needs to keep coming to Al-Anon. I'm married to a game player, and I'm a game player. And just because he got sober, that don't mean he don't drive me up the wall. He does. On a regular basis. But when you know you're climbing, it ain't so bad. But little by little, we're able to solve some of these things. One of the games that he and I always used to play, he'd look at me, you know, and he'd say, I think you could use a game of golf. Now, that's what he said. That is not what he meant. He meant he wanted to play golf, and he didn't have anybody else to play with, and I was it. Well, I know the rules of the game, so I have a whole list of things he wants me to do that I keep putting it off so I can play the game with him. And I'd tell him that I was going to defrost the freezer or clean out the back porch or even maybe my purse, you know, and we bandy that back and forth, and pretty soon he lets me win, and he goes off and enjoys himself playing golf, and I'm stuck with the freezer and the oven and the back porch, see? Well, I didn't like the way that game was turning out, and so I decided to turn it over. And one night I went to a meeting, and I heard this girl say, just out of a clear blue sky, whenever Paul asks me to do something that I really don't want to do, I merely say, I'd rather not. Now, I like that. That had kind of a classy ring compared to what I was had been saying. And so I kind of filed it away. And a few nights later, I go to another meeting in an entirely different area. And there she is again, and she says the same thing. Whenever Paul asks me to do something that I really don't want to do, I merely say, I'd rather not. Now, you figure it out. I turned that over. I've been to two meetings in two separate places, and that female has been there to give me God's message, right? Well, the next time Eddie looked at me and said, I think you could use a game of golf. I looked him right in the eye. I said, I'd rather not. He said, what the hell do you mean you'd rather not? I said, well, I don't really know. That's all Maxine ever tells Paul. But it worked, you see. And that's why I keep coming to Al-Anon. Because I need the strength that I can get to go home and play games with him. And it works out beautifully. I would like to close with a little poem that I use every time I talk. And it may mean nothing to you, which is perfectly all right. It was given to me by my sponsor at a very low time in my life. And the first time that I heard it, I had a mental picture of my kids when they used to come to me with their yo-yos, you know, and they'd have the yo-yo clutched in this hand and the string attached to this hand, and they'd say, come on, Mom, get the knot out of the middle. And there wasn't a way in the world I could get the knot out of the middle of the string unless they gave me the yo-yo. And so now sometimes when I don't have time to remember the whole poem, that's my shortcut. Please, God, I got another knot in the string. But anyhow, the little poem goes like this. As children bring their broken toys with tears for us to mend, I took my broken dreams to God because he was my friend. But then, instead of leaving him in peace to work alone, I hung around and tried to help with ways that were my own. At last, I snatched them back and cried, how can you be so slow? My child, he said, what could I do? You never did let go. So if I don't leave anything else here as my gift to you, I hope you'll try to remember that if you let go, and you let God, and you let the love that we've been sharing here for the last 48 hours be a part of your life one day at a time, you got the recipe for a good day. Because God loves us. We love each other. And I love you. Thank you for asking me to share.